We'd like to welcome you out tonight to the Southern Utah RAC meeting. I'm Dave Black, chairman from St. George, represent public at large. I'd like to start introducing the RAC members. I'll have them start with Rusty down at the far right.
Thanks, Dave. Rusty Aiken, Cedar City, at large.
Tammy Pearson, Beaver County Commissioner.
Berlin King, Bicknell, Agriculture.
Gene Boardman, Hinckley, Public at Large.
Sean Stewart, representing the BLM.
Mike Worthen, Public at Large, Cedar City.
Nick Jorgensen, non-consumptive, St. George.
Kevin Bunnell, I'm the regional supervisor for the Division of Wildlife.
Wade Heaton from Elton, at large.
Riley Roberts, Tropic, sportsman.
Sean Kelly, Fillmore, Forest Service.
Braden Richmond, Beaver, sportsman.
Brian Johnson, Enoch, non-consumptive.
I'd also like to recognize two of our wildlife board members that we have here tonight. We have Donnie Hunter and Steve Dalton. Thanks for coming. First item of the agenda is we need to approve the agenda in the minutes. Assume everybody had a chance to look over that, and I'll entertain a motion.
So move.
Okay. Motion from Mike Worthen, second from Nick. Any discussion? All those in favor? Okay, thank you. Next item will be a wildlife board meeting update. I think probably some of the highlights that we want to go over would be the Bucks Bowls and Once in a Lifetime recommendations. We had a number of motions here at the Southern RAC, and we had some proposals from Sportsmen for Fish and Wildlife. One of them was on the Barney Top. They wanted to start a primitive weapon only area, and for the first year they wanted to break that out as a archery only for elk, and that there's quite a bit of discussion. I think there was a lot of people interested in favor, but they didn't feel like that had moved far enough along that they could make a decision. There's still a lot of homework that needs to be done. And so that didn't pass, but they recommended that they create an action item to start looking at the definition for primitive weapons and try to start getting things in place in case that comes to the RAC and the board again, so we'd have some clear definitions and maybe they'll get some more traction and we might see that again. There was also a discussion and a recommendation from our RAC on the Dutton late season elk. They wanted to eliminate that hunt, and that went through the Wildlife Board and that motion failed. There was also a proposal from SFW on the archery only bighorn sheep on the Zion and the Newfoundland units, and that passed with the Wildlife Board, so we'll see that. There was discussion about the Panguitch Lake unit and the early season deer hunt, and there will be an early season hunt on the Panguitch unit this next year. There was a motion that came out of the blue on the Monroe unit, and they passed to put the spike elk hunt back on that unit.
Rifle hunt.
Rifle hunt.
Yeah.
And then everything else passed as presented. Probably just the other one that there was a lot of interest up north with the electric bike and the waterfowl recommendations. And what the motion was from the Wildlife Board was to accept the 2019 waterfowl recommendations and rule amendments as presented, with the caveat that the electric bike be limited to a Class 1 bike as defined by state and federal regulations. And that passed. So that's probably some of the main highlights. I'll turn some time over to Kevin now for a regional update.
Okay, we're going to do a video here in just a minute, but hold off just a minute. Phil put together a video for us for our kind of end-of-year regional meeting that really kind of highlights all the things that we do here. But before we get to there, at the last RAC meeting, I told you that I had committed to a group of people that I was working with that I'd highlight some cooperation that's going on between sportsmen and the agricultural community, because it seems in this setting we're always looking at the or experiencing the conflict between those two groups. But one thing that I think can really bring those groups, sportsmen in general, and all the agricultural folks together is the wild horse issue. That's a big deal here in southern Utah. And, you know, Tammy may want to add some more to this, but, you know, anytime there's gathers or there's public notices or there's anything that's going on relative to removing wild horses and getting more of them off the landscape, sportsmen, the agricultural community is already pretty well focused on that, and they're pretty active in commenting on that. I think the sportsman community needs to become more focused on that. You need to educate yourselves and figure out, and I can help do that, but we need to figure out how to get involved in that process, because it's a big deal, especially out on our West Desert unit here in our Southwest Desert unit here in the southern region, but in several other places around the state as well. Tammy, anything you'd like to add to that?
I'd second that.
Thank you. And then if you'll turn your attention to the screen here, Phil's got a video he'll show us. And with that, I'll turn the time back to you, Mr. Chairman.
Phil, that was top notch. Thanks. First action item. Item number five on the agenda, 2019 Black Bear Recommendation and Rule Amendments, and Darren will be presenting that for us.
Is that working now? Okay, good. Does it?
A little higher.
Okay. That's good. All right, cool. Great. So, yeah, I'll be presenting our Black Bear recommendations for the upcoming seasons tonight. I wanted to quickly just kind of run through how we manage black bears, just as a quick reminder for the public that are here and for the RAC members that might be a little bit newer. First of all, the mission of the Division of Wildlife Resources is to serve the people of Utah as a trustee and guardian of the state's wildlife. And part of that mission is to actively manage wildlife populations, and we actively manage black bear populations. Hunting is a key component of management. If you want to do population level management, hunting is a very good tool and a useful tool for us to have. We've been managing bears as protected wildlife in Utah for about 51 years. They became protected in 1967. In the mid-80s, we undertook quite a few studies to try to understand better what our bears were up to, what some of those population level interactions were. And as a result of that information, in the late 90s, we put together the first black bear discussion group, which drafted a black bear management plan in 2000. That plan was revisited in 2011, and that's the plan that we're currently operating under. It's began in 2011. It runs through 2023. The plan's goal, overarching goal, is to maintain a healthy bear population in existing occupied habitat and expand distribution while at the same time considering human safety, economic concerns, and other wildlife species. And the plan defines a healthy bear population as one with a proportion of breeding age animals that will maintain population levels consistent with habitat and also maintain genetic variability. So that's what we're trying to accomplish through the plan. The plan has a couple of strategies in order to accomplish that overall goal. The first is that the plan spells out that we will make bear recommendations on 3-year harvest recommendation cycles. And the reason that the plan does that, and the reason that the group that discussed it and put the plan together, put this into place, is that black bears are long-lived, especially compared to other animals. They can live to be easily 20 years old and even up to 30 in some instances we found on the Tavaputs. They have a relatively low reproductive rate, so populations change very gradually over time. A bear only needs to produce, one good litter to replace itself. But over that long period of time, those populations don't change a lot. You don't see big spikes and big crashes. The other reason that we look at these on a 3-year basis is when you're trying to do a population reconstruction, and I'll show you that tonight, you can confound your data if you're constantly increasing the number of permits or bears you're taking each year. That has a potential to make it look like your population's growing when it may not, or growing faster than it may be growing. And so the idea is we make a recommendation in year one, and then we let things stay the same for 3 years, and then we make the recommendation at the end of that 3-year period. We don't change things in between. It also has the benefit of giving people who hunt bears a more stable management strategy. It's more predictable. Things aren't changing every year. People can get used to what we're doing in the guidebooks. I won't go
into detail here unless people have questions. But just quickly, the management plan sets parameters for how we adjust permits. And how permits are adjusted depends on what kind of hunt strategy the individual unit is under. So there are three possible hunt strategies: light harvest, moderate harvest, and liberal harvest. Most of the units in the state, 13, are under the moderate harvest category. Four are light, six are liberal. Just as a thumbnail sketch, the usually moderate is the intent there is to either maintain or slightly allow bear population to increase. Light harvest would be a harvest strategy where you actually want to grow the number of bears in a unit. And liberal are usually placed on units where we have a lot of bears or we have conflict with livestock producers or even agricultural interests. We're actually actively trying to suppress a bear population. And then your permit adjustments are tied to these management parameters, and you would adjust depending on where your harvest, your 3 years of harvest, falls within these categories. Another thing we did since last year, and we had a couple of items that came up during the rack and board process that the board asked us to revisit, and so this year we put together a black bear discussion group. The two issues specifically the board wanted us to look at were the Bookcliffs and the Les Salles hunting seasons. There was some concern, if you remember last year, about hunt dates and how that overlaps big game seasons. And so we put a group together to talk through the details on those. But since we had a group together, we also talked about a couple other things. One, we talked a little bit about opportunities for spot and stock hunting. So these are low success hunts that provide opportunity if people want to hunt bears. And I'll give you some more detail on that as we move through the presentation. We also had some discussions about bait stations and registration. Non-resident pursuit during spring season, that's a hot topic we talked about. And we also had some livestock producer members on that group. So we talked a little bit about livestock and the concerns livestock producers have in relation to bears. This is a list of the organizations who were on that committee and participated. So getting into some data, first of all, statewide harvest success since 2014 has been, you know, pretty close to 50. It dropped a little bit last year, but that was the low year. It's been between, you know, 40% and 50% fairly consistently. It might be worth pointing out that's very high for the West. Most other Western states have much lower, partially due to the fact that they don't allow some of the hunting methods that we allow. We really have high success rates for bears in Utah. And then these are just the actual harvest numbers here, just below it. It's from 2014 through 2018. This is a graph that pretty much shows the same thing. The yellow line here are the number of permits that we've issued over time. And the red line are the number of bears harvested. There was a little bit of a downturn last year, but we're still at a plateau in terms of harvest and permits. One other thing that might be worth pointing out is this the laser? This is when the 2011 plan was put in place, and we actually did a three-year recommendation cycle and then adjusted, but we've kind of gotten away from that the last few years for various reasons. That'll tie in here in a minute. This is the population reconstruction I talked about. So we've talked about this before, where you take harvest data, the age of animals at harvest, and back calculate to try to estimate at least the trend in your bear population. This doesn't include any kind of natural mortality. This is all harvest-related mortality, and this is only black bears that are adults 2 years and older. But this does give you a good idea of what the population's done since 2008 when this graph begins, and it looks like we may be reaching a peak. Things seem to be leveling off a little bit the last couple of years. Bearing in mind that our biggest bear populations are also in areas where we're seeing a lot of drought, and so it could be as a result of some reproductive failures, especially in the southeastern part of the state. The other thing we take into account is depredation. So what this graph shows, and I hope everyone can read it, but these are the damage payments that the division made last fiscal year, so FY18. So from July through June of this year, by county. And so this graph kind of gives you an idea of where the hot spots are throughout the state for bear damage. You can see Carbon and San Pete, Utah and Wasatch are those the higher ones. We always have to take this into account too when we're making our recommendations and try to work with producers where they're seeing damage. When we do have conditions where bears are getting into conflict situations, we have the option, and producers have the option of working with wildlife services, but as an agency, we try to increase opportunity among hunters. And so what this graph shows is wildlife services harvest is this red line. That's remained fairly consistent with again, a growing bear population and increasing numbers of permits to the public. And so as we've grown bears, the public's benefited primarily from additional hunting opportunity. We try to keep wildlife services take fairly consistent. Obviously, we want them to be able to help producers, but if we have an opportunity to give a sportsman a permit, that's the strategy we're after. So on to recommendations. The first thing we're recommending this year is that we get back to that three-year recommendation cycle. And so the recommendations I'm making tonight would begin in 2019 and run through 2021. And then we would take a look at the data, the last 3 years of data, and come back to the RACs with recommendations at that time. There are some safety valves here. And a couple of things. First of all, if we see something in the population that warrants an emergency change, you know, maybe we feel like permits are too high or we have unusual, continued drought and we're not seeing the production, we could bring changes back through the RACs and the board mid-cycle if we need to do that, so if there's an emergency. If we have time to do that, that'd be the preferred option. If it's an emergency situation that's time sensitive, the division director can always close a hunt, and so there's also that option as well. The next recommendation, I just want to give a little bit of background. This graph shows the demand for bear permits since 2007. So the red line are the number of applications for bear permits over time, and the yellow line are the number of resident permits that have been available over time. There's such a difference in that. Remember how when you looked at the permit graph, that graph kind of went like this? Well, there's quite a bit of difference here, and so just scaling, it looks almost flat. Anyway, the take-home here is that demand continues to increase, even at the pace that we've been allowing or offering extra opportunity for permits with a growing bear population. This is the same graph for non-residents and shows it's fewer permits, but it shows basically the same thing. And so one thing that we're recommending this year to maybe try and alleviate a little bit of this is to offer some fall spot and stock bear hunting opportunity beginning at the opening of the general muzzleloader deer season and running through the end of the general any weapon season. As we get into unit by unit permit recommendations, you'll see these. So we've selected some units to try this. One thing that we'll need to do is eliminate the early baiting season on that late November hunt, because that would overlap with these fall hunts, and we don't want people hunting spot and stock with baits in the field. Just informationally, We currently have these types of hunting opportunities on the LaSalle's and the San Juan units. Success on those units runs about 10 to 15%. So similar to some archery hunts, probably general archery season. We expect that's probably what we'd see on these other hunts, or maybe even a little less. Let me go back to that really quickly. We have two strategies. We want to try to do this two different ways. One is by offering a number of permits through the draw that people can draw and then hunt these seasons. And then also we're offering a few that are harvest objective seasons. So the permits are unlimited, but we'd have a quota and the hunt would shut down when those bears were taken. We want to see which one works better. And so we're going to try it two different ways on different units. Our next recommendation, this is the season date question that the group tackled at the request of the Wildlife Board. We're recommending that we change the Book Cliffs Bitter Creek South seasons by eliminating the archery-only season, opening the hunt on the first Saturday in August and running it through November 14th with no dogs allowed from the opening of the limited entry archery elk season through October 1st. So that hunt would open a couple weeks earlier than it currently does for houndsmen. They could hunt that period of time in August before the archery season's open. It would close to hounds during the archery seasons. That's where we get the most conflict between users, is when hounds are in the field and archers are in the field at the same time. And then it would open up again to houndsmen beginning October 1st. The other change to seasons we're recommending is adjusting the spot and stock season on the LaSalle's and San Juan to match everywhere else. So that opener on the muzzleloader deer season through the any weapon season is a little different now, but we're recommending we just make that consistent. All the other seasons that you have in your packets are just adjusted for calendar, so we're not recommending any changes to any of those other seasons. So moving on to unit by unit recommendations. If the notes are in green, that indicates a change. So we're recommending 9 additional limited entry permits on the Book Cliffs Bitter Creek South. We're recommending 2 quota spot and stock permits. So it'd be a quota of 2 in the fall, that fall season on the North Slope Three Corners West Daggett. That unit has 6 limited entry permits and a quota of 5, 2 of which would be spot and stock. On the South Slope Bonanza Diamond Mountain, 3 spot and stock quota in addition to the 31 permits for other seasons out there. In the northern region, northern has hunted bears. They don't have a lot of bears in that part of the state. Up until this year, they've had they put all of their units into 2 hunts. And the northern region has a lot of private land, and we have landowners up there that have had concerns about bears that get into sheep. We kind of went around and around on this in the group. And what we're recommending this year is to split out the private land units in the northern region, Chalk Creek, East Canyon, Morgan, South Rich, put some quota hunts on those units so that a landowner, if they've got a problem with a bear, they can go buy a harvest objective permit and handle their own problem in addition to the assistance they get from Wildlife Services. And we're also recommending an additional 5 spot and stock permits on the Chalk Creek, East Canyon, Morgan, South Rich. And then the other 2 hunting units up there would be Cache Ogden with 9 total permits, 5 of which would be spot and stock, Camas North Slope Summit, 26 permits, 5 of which would be that fall spot and stock. This does affect a conservation tag. Currently there's a conservation tag that's Chalk Creek, Camas, North Slope. So if we move Chalk Creek out, that changes that. We'll bring that up with the board, but I just want to make sure that the RAC was aware, and if you want to weigh in, you're obviously welcome to do so. Central region, Central Mountains Nevo, 20 spot and stock permits. On the Wasatch West Central, we're recommending an additional 2 permits. Central Mountains Manti North, 20 spot and stock permits. The Manti South, San Rafael North, 20 spot and stock permits. No changes on the LaSalle's. 9 Mile, 20 spot and stock quota on the 9 Mile. And no change on the San Juan. Southern Region, on the Beaver, recommending 2 fewer permits this year. On the Dutton, adding 2. On the Panguitch Lake Zion, adding 3. On the Ponsagant, adding 1. On the Plateau, Boulder, Kaparowitz, 20 spot and stock permits. And on the Plateau Fish Lake, 2 additional permits. So those are our permit and harvest recommendations. Moving on to some rule changes that we're recommending. We changed the language in the depredation portion of the black bear rule to allow a landowner to designate a person that can help in control situations. So if we've got problems, especially in the southeastern region where bears get into watermelon and sunflower crops, this is similar to what we do with the lion rule. We allow a person, we can issue them a damage tag to try to help take that bear, and they could designate someone to get that permit. They can't charge for it, and they don't get to keep the animal. This is strictly for damage, to address damage situations. The second recommendation we're making in the southeast and northeastern part of the state, where we've got a lot of interest in bear hunting, we've had some concerns with people rigging dogs and running all night trying to pick up a track. And this is causing a little bit of conflict among users. It also made it difficult on our law enforcement section to try to enforce that. We've already got legal hunting hours, but this is enough of a gray area, and we've had enough concern that we thought we'd try to address this. And so what we're recommending is that dogs may not be rigged. And I'll give you the definition for rigged here in a sec. Dogs may not be rigged from 1/2 hour after sunset to 1/2 hour before sunrise. So that's just, they can't be rigged outside of legal hunting hours, except during the summer pursuit season when legal hunting hours begin at 5 a.m. So essentially, you can't have dogs rigged outside of legal hunting hours. Now, the key here is what rig means in the rule. It means to have trained dogs placed outside of a dog box, kennel, or crate while being transported in or on a motorized vehicle for the purposes of locating or pursuing a bear. So one thing that's come up in the first couple of racks is, well, what if I have a dog that's lost and I've got is a four-wheeler and I want to go pick it up? If you did that, you're not pursuing a bear, that wouldn't be included in this definition. I will get to talk more about that, I think. I know the houndsmen have sent a letter, so I'll leave it at that for now. We're recommending to modify the firearms and archery equipment portion of the rule just to match the new changes in the big game rule. It allows air bows, so it's consistent. And we cleaned up some language in the rule. There was actually a little bit of a discrepancy between the guidebook and the rule on requirements for dog handlers and who can pursue and when they can pick up dogs that get separated during a pursuit. So we just tried to make that language consistent throughout the rule. We added a little bit of language to the portion of the rule that talks about bait and dogs. And what we're recommending is that the rules say that a person may not intentionally start rig dogs at a registered bait station or take with dogs a bear lured to a bait station. The key change there is intentionally. Sometimes we have folks that accidentally run into a bait because they start on a track and the bears hit the bait and their dogs hit it. And so we added that clarification so that if someone if we can prove that someone intentionally takes their dogs to a bait and starts a hunt, that'd be against the rule. And then finally, actually not finally, sorry, we're also clarifying on the requirements where baits cannot be placed. First of all, they have to be 100 yards from water or public road, or half a mile from any permanent dwelling or campground. That hasn't changed. But there was some language in there about that gave the division the discretion to restrict baits in other situations, and it was vague enough it made our attorneys nervous, and so we struck that. I think it, as a practical matter, these two restrictions are sufficient. We are recommending that we modify the check-in portion of the rule to include when a person checks a bear in after the hunt, that they can check and have a permanent tag placed at a regional office or by a division representative. The rule before said that a regional office or a conservation officer, but in practice, we don't just make conservation officers check all these animals in. Biologists do it as well, so we just wanted to make sure that reflected what we're actually doing. And we're also asking for an exact location of kill when bears are checked in. And that's it.
Okay. Thank you, Darren.
Yep.
Are there any questions from the rack?
Yeah.
Riley?
Thank you, Darren.
Yeah.
The first question is on the permit demand. Is there a way to find out the breakdown? I know a lot of people bank points on actual applications looking to draw versus those who are just building points.
Right.
Because that's got that total number is everything included, correct?
I think the numbers we saw tonight are just are not people who put in for points.
That's not points.
Doesn't include people putting in for points. Yeah. That's right.
And then the second question, just because I know it's probably going to be a topic that gets discussed, is the rigging. Can you give us a little bit more of a background on how this came about?
So this is not something that the discussion group discussed. This is something that came up internally. You know, on those units like the LaSalle's and the Book Cliffs, where we have a lot of people hunting bears, a lot of out-of-state interest, we're hearing that hunters are coming into conflict out there on those units. And what's happening is that some people are rigging their dogs on their vehicles, and they're driving all night long. And as soon as the dogs hit on a track, then they'll camp out on that spot. And then as soon as legal hunting hours arrive, they'll let the dogs go. The conflict arises when some people feel like, well, that's hunting when you're not, you know, you're pursuing a bear outside of legal hunting hours. So there was kind of this gray area. We had some people that felt one way and some people felt another way. And so this was an attempt to kind of lay the ground rules. And so everybody's on the same page, and this is what's legal and this is what isn't. The current rule basically just says you can't pursue a bear outside of those times. And this is an attempt to maybe clarify or define what we mean by pursue. And so that's what we're recommending tonight. That's what we're trying to do. Does that help? Yeah.
So, go ahead, Mike. So the pursuit.
Mike, into the mic, Mike.
Okay. Sorry about that. The pursuit that you're talking about here changing is not the dogs pursuing the bear, but the dogs just locating where the bear crossed the road. And then, because I would imagine most of these guys that are hunting bear want to see how big the bear is before they chase it. And if it turned out to be a little bear, they'll just leave it and go on.
Right. Yeah, I think that's true.
And so you're changing the definition to say pursuit means dog on the box.
Right.
And that's pursuit. And I just have a hard time seeing how that is a pursuit.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's, I don't want to steal their thunder, but I think that's how the houndsmen feel as well. Yeah.
Just quick question on the numbers. The only area I saw those decreasing tags is the Beaver, which is my backyard, and I know we're not supposed to talk about our backyard. I'm going to. Just curious for the reason on that.
If one of the biologists knows off the top of their head, I'll let them answer, but do you, Dave?
So we had high female harvest outside of those sideboards from 40 to 45% over 3 years. Two of those years were over that. And so it's just trying to come back within those management guidelines.
All right, and I actually knew that answer. So now the next question I have is... So the follow-up question to that would be, from my experience and from those that I talk with, again, this is my backyard, the population is increasing on the Beaver, and I think we're fairly comfortable saying it is increasing. So this seems like an education problem, not a... The population would dictate more tags, but we need more education, perhaps. What's your thoughts on that?
Y'all, that's a good question. I think there's a lot of bears on the Beaver, a lot on trail cameras, on pictures, and maybe I don't know if it is education or not, but I think I was worried, like, on the spot and stock that we might have higher female harvest, too, and go further and above what we were already trying to do. So I wanted to see us come back and before that. But personally, I think there's quite a few beavers, bears as well.
Any additional questions from the rack? Okay.
Well, my question is, do you have any idea how many bear there are on these different units? Because everybody's talking about how many bears they see on their trail cams, and then you guys seem to be managing... I don't know. You don't know how many there's there.
Yeah, it's difficult when you start getting down to individual units. You just don't have enough data to make a good estimate. But I think we can confidently say statewide we've been growing bears over the last probably 8 to 10 years, and that it looks like statewide we may be seeing a little bit of leveling off. But bear in mind that where there are a lot of bears, that tends to kind of drive things. So it's difficult to drill down any deeper than that. You can do it on units like the LaSalle's or the Bookless where they're harvesting a lot of bears. But those patterns look fairly similar too.
Okay. We just talked about education. What are they talking about? Telling the...
Yeah, just...
He mentioned we killed too many.
Right, how to tell the difference between a boar and a sow, and I guess that assumes that someone doesn't want to take a sow, but they take it because they don't know the difference. And so we definitely can address that in our orientation courses, and maybe a little better. You know, those are some things I've been looking at too. I think some of that could be polished. Sometimes, what Dave mentioned is one trade-off when you move to less success or less, when you move away from hounds or bait, people are less selective. And so, if you're spotting and stalking a bear, you don't always know what it is exactly when you see it. And so we could see some increase in females. And so we're trying to be a little bit cautious on those units that already are outside of our management parameters.
Brian.
I just was curious. I'd heard some talk about the overlap between the baiting, the summer baiting and the houndsman. Is that still to where you can pre-bait these?
Yeah.
That's still there.
What we did last year, Brian, is we allowed used to could bait 2 weeks early. Now you can bait a week early, but you can start hunting immediately. And so they overlap a week. It was a compromise, same as last. We're not recommending any change. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Anybody else? Tammy?
Okay, I'm trying to compare, back and forth where your increases are. Have you correlated the increases with your big payouts, your cash payouts on livestock depredation and those kind of things?
Yes, some of those are in the mix for sure, and some of that was taken into account in past years, but that's definitely something that we look at when we make these recommendations. The other thing too with bears, they're a little different than something like a lion. Usually it's an individual animal that really is the culprit. So if we can get Wildlife Service to take that animal or allow a landowner to take that animal, a lot of times that problem goes away. And so we try that strategy as well with bears.
So do you have any of these, do you collar bears or do the tracking devices and that to try and get some kind of count on them?
What we're doing is we are collaring female bears and we monitor them for those birth pulses, and that can be predictive in when we might see populations grow a little bit. We're not trying to estimate total numbers from that. We just don't have enough collars on the air to do that. So we're trying to get an estimate at least of trend using that, the harvest data and the reconstruction that way.
Okay. Everything that we're hearing, from the counties on our association level is that there's, huge increases statewide.
Right.
And so, the impacts that we hear about obviously are, mostly are the livestock problems and issues. But are you correlating that also with the wildlife depredation part?
Yeah, I think again with bears, we are looking. So we just started a study where we're going to be looking at cougar and bear interactions. There isn't any really hard data, but there has been some speculation that if a bear scavenges a lion kill, that might actually kill a lion or might increase the lion's kill rate. And so we're actually going to look at that a little bit. So we are putting collars on lions on units that have a lot of bears. The book cliffs is one of the mantis, another. And we're going to try to look at that and see what happens. So we'll know what the lion's kill rate is, and then we'll actually go and visit these kills and put cameras and just see what kind of interactions are going on there. So we're trying to get at that and see if we can figure it out. And the book cliffs, they're especially concerned about predation and deer and elk numbers. Yeah.
Okay. Any other questions from the rack? Before I open it up to the audience, I just want to remind you that if you want to make a comment, make sure you fill out a comment card. Give it to one of the officers and they'll bring it up. And if you do have a question that's for clarification or whatever, we'll allow you to do that now. If you come to the mic, please state your name and ask your question, and then in just a few minutes we'll go through the comment cards. So do we have any questions from the audience?
Oh, that was fun.
Okay, we'll move into the comment section then. And the first one is Lynn Kitchen, followed by Bud. And Bud, just a quick question. Did you want to comment on this particular agenda item? Is Bud here? Not on this one? Yeah, on the bears? Oh, okay. Which item did agenda? Do you have an agenda? We're not discussing deer and elk tonight. Is there somebody here you can talk to? Is Teresa or anybody here?
So if it's a question. Yeah, this one's just for... Yeah, so April will be our next meeting when we're talking about big game. But why don't you grab... It looks like one of your questions is use of scopes, and so maybe grab Paul right here in the back, and he can talk with you, and if you have additional questions that he can direct you to a member of our staff, maybe we can at least make it so you didn't travel here completely in vain tonight. Okay. Bryce.
Okay, and so Lynn will be followed by Bryce.
Just turn it on.
It's not on. It's right.
No.
Okay, Lynn Kitchen, just representing myself. And usually I don't make a lot of comments on things, but this past year I felt like I was a little bit more knowledgeable maybe on what was happening on the Beaver and wanted to strengthen a little bit of the comments and maybe the concerns Braden had. My boy had the fall permit, and I was also helping several other people on bait stations and on their hunts. And what I observed was there were a lot of bears on the Beaver unit, and I was very surprised at just the sheer numbers and the sheer size of what I saw. And there was real no problem in finding bears there. And in some places, there would be 9 different bears within 2 weeks cross a trail with just a trail with nothing on it. And it would be my recommendation to I would not worry about not having that number at the original number or even raising it to a higher number than what it is. There's a lot of bears there. One particular canyon that we spent a lot of time in, I think there were 6 bears shot in that one drainage, and that didn't even count the little ones that were running around. There were a lot there, and just every time we went out, we would see bear sign. And so there's a resource there. I know we have to be concerned about they don't reproduce maybe quite as fast as other species do, but there was plenty there to take from. And so that was my comments. Thanks.
Thank you. And Bryce will be followed by Jared Higgins.
Bryce Pelley, Sportsman Fish and Wildlife. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We support the plan as presented. I sit on that group that we spent lots of time, emails. We feel like this is what we can accept, so thank you.
Okay, thank you. Jared, we'll give you up to 5 minutes.
Okay.
And make sure you cover your topics.
Did you guys all get a copy of our letter? Do you have it with you? Okay. Anybody need one?
Maybe give one to this table over here. Down this way.
Down on this end.
Jared.
Jared, down on that end of the table. So I'm Jared Higgins. I'm representing the Utah Houndsman Association. We support the DWR's recommendations with the exception of 2 changes. We don't support the 9 tag increase on the Book Cliffs Bitter Creek South unit. We propose a 0 tag increase on that. It's recommending a 20-40% increase, but it also allows for a 0 increase, and we feel that 9 tags is a little bit excessive due to the fact that we're in drought and a low cub den survival the past year. Item number 2 is the rigging before daylight. I don't know who these guys are that are doing that. I'm sure it's legitimate, but it doesn't make any sense from the eyes of a houndsman, because if you park on a track at 2 a.m. and you don't turn out on it until 5 a.m. or whatever legal turnout is, that bear's running that whole time. He's in a different area code. So these guys that are doing that are probably dumping out on the bear too if they're hunting all night, which falls under the parameters of the existing law. You can't hunt before the legal hunting hours. We do have instances where we go pick up dogs, we throw them up on our rigs. There's not going to be any way for them to tell whether we're rigging bear or transporting dogs. It's going to be not prosecutable. There's other things you could be rigging for right then too, as far as coyotes, coons. How do they differentiate what you're out there doing? We propose that you just stick with the law that you have, no hunting before legal hunting hours. And that's it. We would also like to thank those that participated in the Bear Committee meetings hosted by the DWR, as well as thank the DWR We'd like to thank those that serve and participate in the RAC and the Wildlife Board meetings. We are grateful to have our voice heard along with the voices of others and appreciate the public input process. Thank you for reading our considered proposal. Respectfully, the Utah Houndsman Association.
Jared, quick question.
Yes.
You indicated that you felt like the 9-tag increase was too much. Did you have a recommendation for...
Yeah, we're asking for zero on that.
Okay.
It falls within the parameters of the plan. You know, it could be as high as 20 to 40, but it could also be zero within those parameters.
Okay.
So.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
So that's the end of our comment cards. So we'll close that section and look at comments from the RAC. Okay. Braden?
I'll further comment on my question earlier. On the beaver unit, you know, this is my backyard, and that's the unit I'm familiar with, the unit I'm on. We also had a comment here from the public. The amount of bears on the beaver has gone up significantly. I've lived there 11 years, and the population's gone up significantly. The two units in Utah I spend the most time on are the beaver and the San Juan. And the San Juan has 148 permits, and the beaver has 20. Per the amount of time I'm out in the field, I'm not seeing significantly less bears on the beaver than I am on the San Juan. I average probably about a bear about every day and a half on either of those units. So to decrease tags on the beaver makes me real nervous. In addition to that, the counts that we're seeing come in right now, our fawn population is really low. We've got some concerns with our deer. I would like to be aggressive the other direction, actually, on that unit.
Okay. Thank you. Any comments down here? Tammy?
I'd like to second what Braden said, and also on the Book Cliffs. I'm getting a lot of reports on that end, on their increase on their bears, and so I'd recommend that we keep the plus 9 and increase beavers. And the same on the San Juans. All the reports that I'm getting, there's a significant increase on all of those areas. And it's funny because when you did your chart on your depredation payouts, most everything coordinates with what your the increases that I'm hearing about from the counties.
Okay, let me make sure I heard you right. You recommend instead of a decrease, increase by 1 over the original? Okay. Any additional comments? Mike?
Yeah, I would go along and encourage support of the Utah Houndsman Association on rigging and also on the number of increase holding down to 0 that they indicated.
Okay. Brian?
I guess we should have talked about this during the question part. Are we seeing on that increase of 9 tags, were those 9 tags spot and stock? Were those bait? Were those just tags? Like, how are those getting distributed?
No, those are just tags. They don't have a spot and stock season on the book list. No, that's fine. Just quickly, the reason they're recommending an increase on the book list is they're out of objective. They're high on their male harvest and they're low on their female harvest, so they're out in a good direction on both of those. The plan recommends an increase in permits between 20% and 40%. So doing the math, they should have increased between 11 and 23 tags on the book cliffs. They're trying to hit it right in the middle because they took those 7 archery tags and they distributed them among the different hunts, and those obviously would be a little bit higher success. So they're trying to shoot for the middle ground on that, but that's why that recommendation was made the way it was.
was. I hope that helps.
So the thing that I don't understand then is if they're on the high side of both the male and the female, and maybe we get some clarification from the Hounds Association, you say that it could call for zero, or
yeah,
I just only, maybe help me understand
that. I think there's a misunderstanding between what the houndsmen understand and what the numbers came in as. I just don't think that they realize that that's how it fell out. Normally, if one's out and one's in, then you'd only adjust. You could adjust zero to about 20%. In this case, they're out in both, and so it warrants a bigger increase. Yeah.
Okay, Gene.
On this rigging, I think that. The less regulation we have, the better it is. I don't think it'll help law enforcement to this rule, because then they've got to determine whether it's hunting or whether it's going back to camp. If you're on the LaSalle's and you're camped down there by old LaSalle, and you're hunting clear over on Lost Beaver, you've got a long ways to go back to camp after you finish your hunt. And so I really think that it's better to just have less regulation on this.
Riley.
I can support this as stands. In regards to the numbers, I don't have enough information, I think, is on increase, decrease. I would go with the biologist recommendations for the most part. I do have heartburn on the definition of the rigging. I think that it is too hard to enforce ethics. Ethics is not something that we can regulate. It's just too difficult to do that. And I think that it's probably going to open up a bigger door of hassle rather than the way it currently stands. That's my feelings on it. I think that we've got some guys that are doing that, and maybe we need to get harder with those individuals. I know that with some of the other stuff, we're happy to make some examples of some individuals that are breaking the law and not following these rules, and I appreciate the trying to make it more consistent, trying to get that definition in there. I do appreciate that, but I do think that it opens it up to where it's just it kind of has that feel of regulating to regulate, not necessarily fixing the ethical problem that we're trying to.
I just wanted to address the decrease on the beaver. I recognize we're outside the management plan, which calls for some action, but I think we can all also agree that it's difficult. Numbers, when it comes to bears, it's difficult to really pinpoint where we're at. I have heard from many different people that they feel like the numbers are increasing significantly over the last 2 or 3 years on the beaver. And so I feel like what we've got is probably a little bit of just insignificant data or data that are probably outside of, you know, what's statistically valid. And so I'm having a little heartburn with the decrease of 2 on the beaver as well. I'd propose maybe we just leave it where it is currently.
Anybody else? Brayden, do you have comments?
I'm almost ready to make a motion. If I could ask one question real quick first.
Okay. Before you do, give me an opportunity just to summarize, and we might want to break the motion up.
Let me ask this question, and then I'll turn the mic off for a minute.
Okay.
Going back to the beaver, what are the
how many permits could we do and be within plan? There's always a range, so it's what would keep us inside of the plan on the beaver?
It could be between 0 and 5. Yeah, so I think Dave shot kind of right in the middle there, but 0 is within plan. Yeah.
Okay, so there we could not increase and be within plan.
Right, yeah, you could leave it as is.
Only status quo,
right,
okay.
Because that female's out.
I just wanted to be clear that thanks.
Okay. All right. Verla? Tammy?
It's me. Okay, I do want to say that I support these guys on the Houndsman on their second one. I think you try and out-regulate this and the ethics and that, and your law enforcement's going to be working 24/7 trying to figure this one out, and they need some time off.
Yeah, I agree with the second one of the Utah Houndsmen's. I don't want to go on record just saying the decrease in any bear killing. We've had a lot of trouble in Wayne County. Maybe it's, you know, Wayne Garfield kind of all runs together over there. We had a bear get into Will Talbot's sheep twice last summer, and we had bear kill at least one cow that we've found. And so, you know, when you've got the depredation payment by county, Wayne doesn't even show up there. That's because we didn't get paid for those, I guess. But that's the problem. It's hard to verify when you've got a lot of country you're looking at. The other thing is you increase the permits 20 on the plateau boulder. You feel good about that. Well, spot and stock times 15%, that's 3 bears. And there's a lot of bear out there. I've talked to several guys with trail cams that have seen, and trail cams is on baits, that have seen 5 to 7 different bear come into that bait. And the same thing on the fish lake. There's a lot of bear out there, and you need to be more aggressive on taking them. Whether it's a female or the male, but we need to maybe kill more females. You know, if they live 30 years, 20 to 30 years, that makes up for the low reproductive rate. And that's a lot of stuff they've got to eat. And I know it's not all livestock, but your elk and your deer will take a hit too. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. So what I'd like to do, I think, is just break out these three items separate, and then we'll address the recommendations all together. The three items would include the 9-tag increase on the book cliffs, the rigging, and recommendations for the beaver. So let's, and if you don't want to make a motion on one of these, then that's fine. We'll move on to the next one. But if you do, we'll address them separately. So the first one let's look at is the 9-tag increase on the book cliffs.
I make a motion that we increase, go with the plan to increase the 9 tags on the book list, Bitter Creek and South Unit.
Awesome.
Question.
Okay.
Is that increase you're talking about, isn't that the recommendations of the plan? So really we don't need a motion to increase that. It would just be to accept the plan with that recommendation in there.
Yeah, we can do it either way. Okay. So we have a motion. Let's see if we have a second, and we can address it separate. So do we have a second?
Tammy already seconded.
Okay, so we have a motion, second from Tammy. Any discussion? All those in favor? Hold them up high.
9-tag.
Right. Just on the one thing. Okay, let's go on to the rigging item.
Gene, did you vote in favor of that?
No.
Oh, I'm sorry. So one opposed? One opposed.
Okay, we're going to close it. So pass 12 to 1? No, 11 to 1.
11 to 1.
Because you're not voting.
Right. Okay. Rigging. Do I have a motion?
I'll make it.
Okay. Mike?
I move that we remove the rigging recommendation from the recommendations made by the division on the bear plan.
Until they stay the way that they have been? Okay. So we have a second. Rusty? Any discussion? Gene? Are you voting? All those in favor? Unanimous? Okay. Third one is on.
Hold on, let me.
Okay.
Okay, Mike, so the way that I've put that is the motion is to not support the change to the rigging rule. Does that
exactly
cover it? Okay, so that's the way we've got it.
Okay. Beaver unit.
I'd make a motion on the beaver unit that we, in order to follow the plan, that we would just go back to a zero number there to keep the permits as they were last year. Maybe with a comment to that, that we believe there's increasing populations and ask for some consideration of education to help people kill the boys.
Okay. Do we have a second? Brian? Okay. Any discussion? All those in favor? Unanimous. Okay, now we need to address the remainder of the recommendations as presented. Do we have a motion? Braden?
I'll make a motion to accept the rest as presented.
We have a second from Riley. All those in favor? Okay, thank you. Now we'll move on to the next agenda item, which is item number 6. The Pronghorn unit plans, and Teresa will be presenting.
Thank you.
So we will be going through the Pronghorn unit plans. So the statewide Pronghorn plan was presented and approved by the Wildlife Board last fall. Unit plans are now being presented in accordance with that plan. Typically when we do the statewide plan the following year, we will do the unit plans. With this agenda item and the next one, the moose, these unit plans have never gone through the system before, so this is the first time for these unit plans. And with the unit plans, they will not be presented again unless there will be a major boundary change, a change in the population objective, or if there's a new unit that will be presented. And then all other changes to the unit plans will be approved by the Division of Wildlife Director. And the reason for that, these unit plans are really quite similar to the statewide plan, aside from the, you know, the boundary, the objective. Anyway, so from the statewide plan, just a recap, we now manage all units and subunits for a 3-year average age of harvested animals between a 2- and 3-year-old, and taking trends into account. We will use archery and muzzleloader hunts to distribute hunters and provide additional hunting opportunities.
The population goal and objective. For the population management goal, we like to manage pronghorn to their population objective and within the carrying capacity of the available habitat. And the statewide population objective, of course, is just a sum of all of the unit management plans. So the population objective and estimates statewide for what we're recommending, the sum is 21,555, and we currently estimate our population to be at 17,355. And we'll just go through these region by region. You can look over each of the units. The sum for the central region, the population objective, they want to manage for 2,200 animals in three different units, and they currently estimate that they've got 1,000 pronghorn. In the northeastern region, the population objective for five units is 4,275, and they estimate that they've got just over 3,400 animals. For the northern region, they've got six units up there, and they want to manage for 2,430. They currently estimate that their population is at 2,035. For the southeastern region, they have six units also, and the population objective for those combined is 4,000, and they currently estimate that there's just over 3,600 pronghorn. For the southern region, we've got the Southwest Desert, the Fillmore Black Rock, the Beaver, Mount Denton / Pontagon, the Plateau, which is the Parker Mountain herd, the Kaparowitz, Panguitch Lake / Zion, and the Pine Valley. So those combined, we want to manage for 8,650 pronghorn. We currently estimate that we've got just over 7,100 pronghorn. For transplant sites, the sites were listed in the statewide plan in Table 4, but we are proposing a few additional transplant sites. Those are the North Slope, Antelope Flat, Bear Top, Clay Basin, Connor Basin, Death Valley, and Goslin Mountain. If that is approved, we will amend Table 4 in the statewide plan to include these sites. As far as habitat improvement, we want to still work to improve water distribution and maintain existing water developments, conduct treatment projects to improve forb production, and also identify migration routes and corridors and any other barriers that may impede pronghorn. On that note, we will be, over the next 2 weeks, we will be putting some radio collars on pronghorn out on the Southwest Desert, Pine Valley, and onto the Beaver, right? And so we're doing that in conjunction. The BLM has pitched in some money, so we appreciate that, and that will help us learn a little bit more, especially with some of the green energy projects that they've got going on out there. And that's it.
Thank you. Questions from the rack? Well, got some down this way. Let's start right here with Nick.
Yeah, Teresa, could you just expand a little bit on water distribution so that I understand that? Increase it by doing what?
For pronghorn, it's a couple different ways. So Jim Lamb up on the Plateau unit, he's done projects to put new improved clay liners in existing ponds. A lot of it in pronghorn habitat is going to be water developments such as guzzlers. So artificial water sites.
Thank you.
Gene?
Mm-hmm. We like to hunt pronghorn, and we've drawn a few tags over the last few years. We've never been asked anything about to determine age on our bucks. So how is this age objective been determined?
That's a great point, Gene. We collected age several years ago. We did for a period of time, and then we stopped for a while. We will start again collecting teeth. So that will start up again. But there was a period of time that we were not collecting teeth. But we'll start again now that we're managing on an age objective. Prior to that, we weren't managing on an average age. So.
Okay. Sean, did I see your hand? Nope. Who else? Merlin.
Okay. When you count these pronghorns, do you count all of them, or do you count adults? I mean, like on the buffalo, they're not a buffalo till they're a yearling.
We count all of them, and then we add in a multiplier for a sightability. We count all of them. We do try to classify them, especially bucks, but every animal counts, and then we times that by a factor to add any animals that we may have missed.
Okay, so I was wondering, because I think you counted 700 on the Parker Mountain, 700 something last spring, and now you've got 1,400.
That we have, or that we counted?
That we counted, and then we have.
Jim will come to the mic.
We counted a few more than that, Verlin, then we added in production for this year, and so that's where we came up with that estimate.
Okay, while you're there, we were figuring there was like 1,500 or more. Do you have an idea what happened to that 500? That
we put some radio collars on those a year ago in December to see if we could get a handle on what mortality is out there to help us get our model to fit what we observe on the ground. There's some disparities there. Our model indicates that we should have more pronghorn out there than we actually can find. What we found in the first year of our collar deployment is that hunters can kill pronghorn. And other than that, they don't die much. And I thought that as dry as the summer was, we'd have some losses, but we didn't. Well, so it's a little bit of a mystery.
And as open as the winter was, I thought you'd have a loss.
Yeah.
No one had lost.
They're doing very well. But there's not as many there as we anticipated.
Okay. And the other question was, you were talking about habitat improvement. We hauled a lot of water out on that Parker Mountain last summer, spring and fall, and does the DWR have a program to kind of take part of the
In conjunction with the Parker Mountain grazers, in the last 6 years, we put $120,000 into pond repair, cleaning and lining with clay to help those ponds hold water when we get it. But we don't purchase water or haul water. But we have put that much money into trying to make more water available across that whole mountain.
Okay, so is that just the Parker Mountain, but what about the BLM and the forest?
We were able to do a couple of ponds on the BLM, but ponds that fall within the severe river drainage, we have a real struggle with the water right to do much with those ponds, and we haven't been able to do any ponds on the forest yet with those monies. It's all been on the state land block.
Okay. Any other questions on my right? How about on my left? Wade.
So admittedly, I'm no pronghorn expert, but I have to ask. I recognize Southwest Desert is a huge unit, but 3,200 animals is a gigantic number. I guess number one is, why is it so high? And number two is, can we sustain that?
It is a huge unit. It pretty much goes from Cedar City to Delta and to the Nevada border. Jason can speak to it, but even when you fly, there's just so much country out there that's still available.
I've done a few calculations on that objective, and that is one pronghorn for every 651 acres of pronghorn habitat. That is fewer pronghorn per acres than any other unit in the state. You look at some adjacent units, and it's like one pronghorn for every 250 acres. So one for every 650 is still low.
Sure. No, that makes sense. So if they're like every other wildlife species, I'm assuming they congregate in certain areas. Are we impacting some of the grazers? I mean, are they congregating in some areas and having real impacts and causing problems?
Not that I'm seeing, and not that I'm hearing from the producers.
Comment down here? Tammy?
I thought somebody else was going to talk. You're just happy Gibb's not here right now, because he'd argue with you. Southwest Desert's my backyard. It's also our BLM permit. And I hear a lot about Southwest Desert, and I think our biggest impact is not only just per acreage, but you add the horses on top of that and your elk numbers and whatever else. That's a huge number. So I agree with you, Wade. I personally, I mean, we've got on our place this summer, I counted over 350 head running on, but we're the only water in the valley right there during the summertime, because that's where my cows are. But right now, when they're all herded up, and you'll see 50, 60, 80 in a bunch or more. So it is a huge amount.
Okay, I think we're ready for a motion. I guess a question that I have for Kevin or somebody is, what's on the table? I mean, are we talking about the objective, if we agree with it, or if we have a motion that we think it might be too high, or we can bring that up now? Is that what we're doing?
Yeah, so this is each of the unit plans, and so the two parts of the unit plans that will come to the rack are these numbers, the population objectives, and then if we had a boundary change on a unit, that would also come to the through the rack. So we're not presenting any boundary changes right now, right, Teresa? This is just so what you're approving is the set of numbers, which are the population objectives that Teresa has presented.
With no tags or anything like that.
No, this is just the plans and the objectives. We won't set tag numbers until April.
Okay. So is that clear? All right. We're ready to entertain a motion. Brian.
I was going to make a motion that we accept the proposal, accept the division's proposal as presented.
Okay. Do we have a second? Riley? Okay. Any discussion? Okay. All those in favor?
Two.
Any opposed?
Two.
That'd be nine.
Written.
Well, you're right.
10 and 2.
Yeah, sorry.
Okay. Okay, so now let's move on to the next item then. We're on the Moose unit plans, item number 7, and Teresa will also present.
All right, So kind of the same deal here. The statewide moose plan was presented and approved last fall by the Wildlife Board, and now the unit plans are being presented in accordance with that plan. Again, unit plans won't come back through unless we do a major boundary change, a change in the population objective, or if a new plan, a new unit plan is being presented. All other changes will go through the DWR director for approval. So we've got 10 unit plans that are being presented, none of which are down here. We've got, I won't read them to you. But from the statewide plan, objective one says we want to increase hunting opportunities as populations allow while maintaining quality hunting experience, and we manage for a three-year-old average age of harvest of bulls. We use subunits to maximize hunting opportunities and distribute hunters. Here are the population objectives and estimates in the state. We'd like to manage for 3,400 moose statewide, and we currently have an estimate of just over 2,500 animals. The moose transplant sites will occur in accordance with Table 5 in the statewide plan. We would like to add a few additional sites, and that is on the Camas unit. We've got Shingle Creek, Beaver Creek, and Norway Flats. On the North Slope, Dahlgren Creek, Dowd Mountain, Elk Park, Henry's Fork, Sheep Creek Lake, and Spirit Lake. And then on the South Slope, Charlie's Park, Lighty Peak, Lone Park Reservoir, and Mosby Mountain. If approved, we would amend Table 5 in the statewide plan to include these sites. For habitat improvement, we want to preserve and regenerate mountain mahogany, aspen, and riparian vegetation, implement projects through the WRI to benefit moose, and maintain populations at appropriate densities to maintain the habitat quality. That's it for moose.
Okay, any questions from the RAC? Okay, hold on, we'll go with Brian, then I'll pass it down.
Just Teresa, just for me, WRI.
The Watershed Restoration Initiative that
thank
we
you.
Do funding through for projects.
Okay, thank you, Nick. We'll go this way.
Just out of curiosity, what is our current moose trend? What's our population trend? Are we
the trend?
Wild?
I don't know.
Up or down?
I can answer that.
So the trend in the last, in the most recent years, and Darren may be able to add some to this as well, has slowly started to increase. We were in a downward trend, and moose, especially Shiras moose, were in a downward trend nationwide from about the early 2000s through probably 2010, 2012. We've put a lot of research into moose in Utah. There's some disease issues with moose, Iliophora, and then some parasite issues that limit moose production, and those are really cyclic and driven with weather. And so we went through a bad time frame, probably a decade or more, but I think moose have started to stabilize and maybe increase a little bit now.
Thanks, Kevin.
Right there.
I have very limited moose experience. We had one in Richfield once, and that's about it.
He got killed.
I think we move to a motion. Do you have a question, Rusty?
So is the population, Teresa, is that the same as the last plan, or increase or decrease?
Do you know what? We've never actually done the unit plans before, so this is just what we're taking a stab at managing for.
What about the statewide? Did you have the 3,500?
Yeah, and that's just compiled the unit plans, but this is the first time that we've ever taken moose and pronghorn plans through, so we've never had those population objectives set before.
Do you have conflicts with livestock, with moose in the state?
Not that I'm aware of.
Conflicts with moose are usually when they're coming down into town, Park City, places along the Wasatch Front, Morgan, when we get moose down amongst people.
Tammy.
Just quick question. What's your moose transplants? How many are you looking at on that? And is that this year, this next year, or what's your plan?
I think it's more as it becomes available. Kevin, take a stab at that.
So Tammy, because of the state of our populations, I don't see us doing any moose transplants within the next year or so. There was a time, like in the Ogden unit, when we were moving a lot of moose out and sending them actually to Colorado. And so as our populations cycle back through, and we do some habitat improvements and we get our populations increasing again, those are places that we would like to move moose to in the future. I don't see that happening within the next couple of years. No, there's no population objectives. If those transplant areas aren't part of a current unit plan, then that unit plan would come through. I think these are, as I looked through that list, there are already moose in those areas. So this is to try to just redistribute moose within units that already have moose.
Braden, do you have a question?
Yeah, I do. Sorry, I just don't mean to prolong, but just a question. Where these are the first times we're actually having population objectives and unit plans, I'm curious on the Ogden, where it is 70 over the objective. The objective is 450 and the estimate's 520. Just kind of curious, that would imply that it's significantly over objective. How is that objective established, and are we seeing problems on that unit because of that high number?
Braden, I can talk to that, and Darren may add some more. What we're seeing on the Ogden unit is degraded habitat, and so we need to reduce that population, let habitat recover before we start building again.
Okay, I think I'm ready for a motion. Gene. Oh.
On these moose transplants, beaver listed. Is there any moose on beaver?
There is currently not, but that is on Table 5 of the statewide plan. It is listed as a potential site. Here's a map that shows. So we've got a little spot there on the fish lake and then on the beaver. So if the time came, we do a unit plan for those units, and they are potential transplant sites. We currently don't have any on the beaver that we're aware of. Every few years, someone will spot one on the fish lake unit.
Okay. If we did get moose on the beaver, it'd be a long time before you had a huntable population. Meanwhile, they'd be quite a high maintenance species to keep there. And so I have a hard time seeing beaver as a good alternative as far as hunting goes. Maybe the aesthetic value of people going out and observing moose, maybe, but I don't see that is viable for hunting, and it'd take a lot of effort, a lot of money to ever get it that way.
Okay, we're ready for a motion. Brian.
I make a motion that we pass the division's proposal as presented.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. Okay, all those in favor? Thank you. Okay, we're ready to move on to item number 8, CHA, rule amendments. Avery Cook.
Cook, the Upland Game Project leader for the Division of Wildlife. The first presentation I'll be going through is some...
Hey, Rick, can you get closer to the mic?
Is that? Okay. All right, I'll start over. Mavery Cook, Upland Game Project leader for the Utah Division of Wildlife. And the first presentation I'll be going through today is some changes to the commercial hunting area rule. Just for a little background on commercial hunting areas, CHAs, in the state, there are areas of private land where privately raised pen-reared game birds are released for hunting purposes. And these areas provide some additional hunting opportunity for the Utah public. With about 19,000 annual hunter days, that's the numbers from this last season. We've currently got 76 registered CHAs within the state, and these commercial hunting areas are regulated by the Division of Wildlife because they have potential impacts on both wintering and breeding wildlife, both other game birds and other wildlife species in the state. There's potential for disease transmission from these high-density pen-reared rearing areas to both wild populations and to commercial poultry producers. And there's also potential for lethal take of some of our resident game birds that are similar in appearance to hen pheasants. So commercial hunting areas in the state can be permitted to release pheasant, chucker, and quail species. There's about 90,000 pheasants released each year, about 16,000 chucker, and about 2,000 quail amongst those 76 commercial hunting areas. The changes the division is proposing today is primarily to streamline and simplify the administration of the program, so basically less paperwork and less of a burden on the operators applying, and also less work for the DWR in processing those so we can get them turned around quicker. So these rule changes should eliminate some redundant applications, allow for digital mapping, simplify the annual reports, make some updates to boundary marking requirements, clarify some other rule language, and also make a couple changes to some disease requirements. So the first proposed change is to update map requirements. Currently, the rule requires paper USGS maps and county plat maps. We're proposing changing the rule to allow us to accept digital maps so that people could either draw the polygon online on our website or send us a digital file with that boundary. And also require boundary verification for renewal applications. As the rule currently sits, there's no boundary mapping requirement on renewals, but sometimes we'll get 20 years worth of renewal applications with no verification of the map. So all this would do is we would be able to send out a map with the renewal application so that the operator can just verify that we have the correct boundary and that what we've got matches what's on the ground. Second change would be to update acreage requirements. Currently, each commercial hunting area is limited to 1,920 acres or three sections. And we're looking at changing that acreage requirement to nine sections or 5,760 acres. We've got a number of commercial hunting areas in the state that exceed that current acreage cap. And as a result, the operators just have to turn in two applications or three applications for an area that's essentially operating as a single commercial hunting area. So just trying to reduce redundant applications there. And we would retain the 180-acre minimum size for a commercial hunting area. We had some comments that the current requirement of needing to be posted every 300 feet was a bit excessive, so we're looking at changing that signage interval to every 300 yards, and that would match with the CWMU rule. Currently, the pieces of a CHA have to be one contiguous piece. We're looking at updating the rule to remove that requirement for contiguous tracks, but change that where each track must still be a minimum of 180 acres, and all pieces of a commercial hunting area must fit within a 10-mile diameter circle. So just kind of a few examples of how that would play out there. That leftmost one, it would just be one big block. Obviously, that would fit within that 10-mile diameter circle. The second example there is just a number of smaller blocks spread out. We've got some commercial hunting areas in the state that are either separated by a road or corner to corner. We currently have to turn in two applications for, again, what's operating as a single commercial hunting area. So that would allow those applications just come in as a single application. In that third example, if the two blocks you had did not fit within that 10-mile diameter circle, there would still have to be two separate applications. And that fourth example is just kind of a more realistic example of a commercial hunting area in the state where they currently have a big block of land. They have to turn in three applications. Under the new rule, they would just have to turn in a single application. In the current rule, there's a provision for a season extension that we are basically is conditioned on not impacting any other wildlife. As a result, we're really never able to approve that season extension, so we're looking at removing that unused provision that we can't really use from the rule so that people aren't wasting their time requesting it and we're not having to spend time saying why we cannot approve it. Under the current rule, the application dates, or we just have a single application period per year, looking to just change it so that there'd be rolling applications for new commercial hunting areas where an operator could turn in an application any time of the year. As far as shooting hours go, there's a provision where if the commercial hunting area is adjacent to a waterfowl management area, then they're bound to basically waterfowl rules, so a half hour before sunrise to sunset. Are proposing to change that to be consistent with other resident game birds in the state, so half hour before sunset to half hour after. And then looking at adding avian influenza and mycoplasma to the disease testing requirements, which is currently just salmonella. This is to make this rule consistent with the Department of Ag rules for importation of birds into the state. This would only apply if the birds were coming from a non-National Poultry Plan improvement sources. Part of this is from kind of emerging disease concerns that we've heard both from the agricultural community, the Department of Ag, and our state wildlife veterinarian. Especially with avian influenza, we have avian influenza present in the state in our waterfowl populations, and there is potential for transfer to these high-density pent and reared bird operations. So we want to have this in place to minimize the risk of either transferring disease to our wildlife populations or to poultry producers within the state. Also proposing to update some reporting requirements. Currently, the rule requires reporting by date. We would be looking to change that just to require season totals, simplify reporting. And then the rule currently requires all the mortality on a commercial hunting area for non-hunting reasons be reported. And we're proposing to change that the mortality would only need to be reported for unusual cases of mortality, such as sickness, disease, bad feed, or other unknown causes, and also to have those disease or sickness, bad feed, other unusual mortality reported immediately so that we could get on top of it before those disease outbreaks were had a chance to spread or get out ahead of cases of bad feed. We had an incident a couple years ago where there was some bad poultry feed from a producer in the up in northern Utah that killed a bunch of our both day-old birds and some other commercial hunting area growers had a bunch of birds die off, so we didn't hear about it till about 5 months after the fact, whereas if we were able to hear about it earlier, we would have been able to work with Department of Ag and hopefully prevent some of that. And there's also a few additional wording revisions that don't change the rule but clarify the meaning of a few statements in there. Thanks.
Thank you. Any questions? Tammy.
Okay, so on your little plots that you had there, does each one of those have to be 180 or the total of each?
So the minimum block size would be 180 acres.
Okay, on each one of those parcels, right?
Correct.
Not everything combined?
Correct.
Okay, all right.
Okay, any further questions? Comments? Motion? Tammy?
I should recuse myself though because I have a family member that does this.
Go ahead and make a motion. Yeah. Sure.
It's not gonna come back and haunt me. Here, Rusty's gonna.
I'll get thrown under the bus. I'll make a motion to accept the recommendations as presented by the division.
Okay. We have a motion from Rusty, a second from Brian. All those in favor?
11 and 1 withdrawal.
Okay. All right, we'll move on to item number 9, which is the sage-grouse translocation proposal. Avery Good, Gossel.
Next presentation will be the greater sage-grouse population augmentation for the Sheep Rocks Mountain sage-grouse management area. Just a little bit of background on sage-grouse in general and Sheep Rocks in particular. So we've had let counts recorded back from the late 50s, and over that time period you see a consistent cycling of the population. Every 9 to 10 years we've got a peak and a trough. Over the long term we see a slight gradual decline where those highs are a little lower and those lows are also a little lower. As a result of that kind of range-wide, sage-grouse have been petitioned a number of times to be listed under the Endangered Species Act, but due to proactive conservation measures both within Utah and throughout the rest of the range, especially like in here in Utah through our Watershed Restoration Initiative and all that habitat restoration through research and through our conservation plan, they were deemed not warranted for listing in 2015. However, we do have one population in the state that is not doing well. If you look at our populations on a statewide basis, which is that blue line on the graph, you can see that they kind of have that normal cyclic behavior where they've got those regular peaks and troughs. And then that orange line is the Sheep Rocks. So they were cycling with the rest of the population in the state up through 2011-2012, when instead of coming back up out of that last peak, they continued on a downward trajectory. As a result of that kind of decoupling and the Sheep Rocks population declining, we implemented quite a few conservation measures, both habitat improvement projects within the sage-grouse management area, some additional predator control, and also a sage-grouse augmentation, so transplanted into the area. So the Wildlife Board approved that for 2016, 17, and 18. And over those 3 years, we moved to 120 sage-grouse, which was broken out into 90 females and 30 males. And as a result of that work that we've done in those transplants, we've seen the trend in that population reverse, and it's going back up. I'm here today just to request an additional 5 years extension to the translocation release site in the Sheeprock sage-grouse management area. So as a state-sensitive species, there's a few requirements for translocation. One is having a management plan, and that's in place. And the second is to pass the request through the Resource Development Coordinating Committee, and that has gone through the RDCC, and there was no comments returned. The final step is Wildlife Board approval. So we're just, again, requesting the Sheeprock Mountains sage-grouse management area, which is there in red, be approved as a transplant location. And we will be planning on getting birds from the Parker Mountain or box elder. Those two populations are genetically similar. They're very robust populations, and they're geographically close enough that we can logistically do it, but far enough away where the birds won't just fly right back. So we're requesting to transport and release up to 40 sage-grouse per year. We won't necessarily do all 5 years. We'll be monitoring the population through LAC counts. We also have one more year of a research study where we'll be collaring the transplanted birds, and then we'll continue monitoring those birds until their radio collars have run out of batteries for additional years. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Mike?
Yeah, on the collared bird, or on the birds that you've transplanted up into the Sheeprocks, what percent are staying there? I mean, I'm sure there's some that just take off and go wherever, but you've got to be having a pretty good impact.
Yeah, so I don't have exact numbers on how many are there. Probably over 90% are staying there. They do have quite big movements when they're first put down in the Sheeprocks, but often they'll kind of circle and then come back to the release site. We will be releasing them on active leks so that they're, when we release them, we try and release them when there's strutting males on the leks, so they kind of home in on that area and come back.
Okay. Tammy?
So my family, my husband was crazy. He loved birds, and he was really into this kind of stuff and passed it on to my son. So we've raised every kind of bird imaginable. And we've sold birds, and the one thing that I've noticed, and this is just kind of a common sense thing, and I don't know if this is something that would help you guys out. Have you ever tried to do the temporary nets and then feed them and keep them in that area instead of just turn them loose?
A soft release?
Uh-huh.
We have not done a soft release as far as putting out flight pens and stuff. We do try and do kind of a softer release where we will, on this plan, we'll catch them one night, hold them a day, put them on the lek where they'll be strutting males. If there's no strutting males there, we're planning on putting out decoys and recordings, and then have basically a little slow opening of the release box so they walk out onto the lek. And some past research has shown that to be effective.
Okay, because I know some of the stuff that we've turned loose, and this is, seems silly, but we used to raise peacocks. And those suckers will find their way home. I don't care if you're 50, 100 miles away. You turn them loose and they will find their way home. And it's just like the homing pigeons or whatever else. And, you know, I don't know if that's a possibility to throw up some of those fly pens. That's just a kind of a temporary thing to hold them for a few days or a week or something.
Yeah. Well, luckily, they're not quite as good as finding their way home as homing pigeons. So in this population in particular, it's pretty isolated. So we do see almost all of them staying at the release location because it's kind of an island of habitat. So that they'll usually do these little circles, realize there's nothing else out for them, and come back. So.
Yeah, Tammy, I would agree with you completely. If we were having a hard time keeping them there, but 90% of them are staying, so it's kind of one of those things. If it's not broke, don't fix it.
Okay, Sean.
Can you offer any insight into why that population, I mean, what did you guys see out there, why it didn't recover back in 2012? I mean, usually it's a convoluted answer, but something in particular you noticed?
For this population, if you kind of look at the threats to sage grouse, you can basically check every one of them off out there, so it's kind of death by a thousand cuts. So we've had habitat loss, both from fire, from invasives, as far as burning up the sagebrush and then getting displaced by pinyon and juniper encroachment. There's, when you get to such a low population level, predation has a larger relative impact. More human recreational use causing disturbance. Quite a few factors out there.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Comments? Tammy?
So this is one of the state designated areas, right? Or is this a federal designation on this lick?
This is on a state designated sage grouse management area.
So the new sage grouse plan just came out. What, the end of, what was it, Thursday or Friday or something? Is that going to affect any of this?
This should not be affected by the federal plans.
Okay, the way I understand it is they're giving more authority to the local, to state and local on their own management, what we've been fighting all along, but I just want to see where we're at there.
I have not had a chance to fully review the latest draft of the plan.
But it should mesh nicely.
Okay. I think we're ready for a motion.
Can I make a motion to accept as presented?
Okay. Do you have a second? Who said you? Okay. All those in favor? Okay. Passes unanimous. Last item is to look at the 2019 RAC schedule. Does this require a motion, or we just talk about it?
So the schedule that we've put down here kind of mirrors what we did this year, where we bookend the year with Beaver and Cedar City, with the first two being in Beaver. That puts one of the big game racks in Beaver and one of the big game racks here in Cedar City with April and November. And then in between, we go to Richfield and Washington County. We've been in Hurricane in the past, but it could be another location in Washington County. That's for usually when we do the fishing regulations, because it's probably our largest concentration of fishermen in the region. So with times, so the standard starting time would be 7 o'clock, but we stray from that on half of the occasion. So 5 o'clock start times for April and November with the big game racks, and then a 6 o'clock start time in December like we did tonight. So is that agreeable to everyone, or is there any changes that anybody would like to propose that we can talk about? Does everybody feel okay about it? Okay. We'll just put that out as our rack schedule for next year. Thank you.
Okay, so if you look on the bottom of the agenda, there's no meetings in January, February, or March. So next time we meet will be in April in Beaver. Okay. Call this meeting adjourned.